So first of all, thank you very much to Jean-Louis for this invitation. When German architecture of 20th century is on the agenda, I don't exaggerate if I say that classical modernism and Bauhaus, you all know Bauhaus, dominate the narratives. But everybody who travels through the country and looks out for architecture from the 14 years of the Republic of Weimar, when modernism had its breakup, will realize that in point of fact, the building production was quite different and closer to something else. Henry Russell Hitchcock already in 1929 had introduced the term of new tradition, a kind of non-modernist modern. One of the most influential architects of this new tradition in Germany was Paul Schmitthenner. Born in 1884, in the same generation as the well-known protagonists of modernism, Gropius, Mies van der Rohe, or Le Corbusier. I show you here two houses, to the left Le Corbusier, to the right Schmitthenner. Both houses were built at Stuttgart, in 1927 and in 1930, just to show the possible contrast of architectural positions in the late 1920s. In my presentation, I have made a very selective choice of works of Schmitthenner. So, I mean, I don't show you, you will not find out the whole quality of his work. I just have selected examples that show the relationship to politics. So let me begin with a statement of 1933 by the young Philip Johnson, who called Schmitthenner on one hand an outspoken enemy of the modernist new objectivity, but on the other hand he described his buildings as really made better and in terms of intention more modern than much in Germany. And this is, I think, a striking judgment by someone who at that time was a clear advocate of modernism in architecture and to whom, together with Henry Russell Hitchcock, we owe not less than the term international style, a label with long-range impact for nearly half a century. Schmitthenner grew up in Alsace during the German period after 1870. As the son of an Alsatian mother and a civil servant, immigrated from Germany. After leaving the Polytechnical School of Karlsruhe, where he had been a lazy student, as he admitted later, Schmitthenner was hired as city architect in Colmar in Alsace in 1907 at the age of 23, so very young. He soon felt embarrassed by the fact that at his building sites, the carpenters and the masoners understood much more of construction than him, the academically trained architect. So he was, in a way, ashamed by this lack of experience he had not. So in his free hours, he joined the office of a private architect, Eduard Spittler, in order to be his apprentice. The building, realized with the collaboration of Schmitthenner, was the new orphanage of the city. And you see here, noteworthy are some details here, such as the affinity to buildings from around 1800, framings of windows and corner strips in red natural stone, which Le Grès des Vosges, typical elements of vernacular architecture in Alsace. Through Spittler, Schmitthenner came into contact with a very self-conscious cultural and architectural regionalism in Alsace, which in this special territory, not necessarily, but sometimes carried a spirit of political opposition against Berlin, against Prussian dominance in the Bismarck Empire. With an improved understanding of region and crafts, Schmitthenner restored a city gate in Riquewihr, a small city in Alsace, famous for its wines. This and a small custom post in regionalist architecture in Colmar are the only objects officially known as of his work from that early period. Let me skip some stations of Schmidhenner's career to see the architect in 1914 arrived in Berlin at the Imperial Ministry of the Interior. He had been hired for a program for garden cities for workers of state-owned armament factories. Schmidhenner realized a much-noted series of exemplary estates in which entries into reform were given a chance, such as garden city, cooperative housing, real estate reform, and contemporary housing hygiene. You see here the plan of Staaken near Berlin from 1914 to 1917. It was the first and biggest one of these garden cities built under strict economic limits, so that efforts in rational planning and construction were needed. In the plan, we have houses grouped together in the manner of a modular system. Only five different floor plans. You see them in the graphic scheme on the left, with elevations at the bottom of the plan. So five different floor plans are given as basic metrics of five types only, but with great variety in the facades. On this basis, a large number of equally standardized finishing elements were built in. Here, for the first time in the country, and certainly unexpected from the side of an institution commonly seen as reactionary, I mean, the ministry from the Kaiser, yeah? Mm-hmm. And certainly, a systematic use was made of standardized types of ground plans and building components. Schmidhenner's main objective, however, was to make this garden city a pioneering project in standardization, but to evitate its aesthetic consequence, which might turn into monotony. So Staaken is rich in elements which cater to the nostalgic longing of the modern industrial worker for the familiar order and manageable size of small town life, evoking the images of the North German Heimat. You see here the marketplace of that garden city, houses with shops, facades in brick, like in Northern Germany, and there was a special thing remembering the Dutch quarter of Potsdam, this city near Berlin, of the 18th century, these with these gables. And it's a fine example to show how Schmidhenner could switch from Alsace regionalism into a Brandenburg regionalism, looking at the landscape nearby. Staaken was one of the prototypes foreseen to replace the speculative housing fabric of Berlin with very high density and lousy hygiene at that time, very ill-reputed and for good reasons attacked by the activists of reform. But before Berlin could continue its growth with garden cities and modern settlements, there was World War I. After the ceasefire of November 1918, 5 years of permanent political crisis followed, which on one hand, feeded political and architectural utopia, but gave few chances to realizations on a bigger scale. And in the first moments of the revolution of 1918, the avant-garde of artists and architects gathered in the Arbeitsrat für Kunst, in English, Workers' Council for the Arts, under a program where artists devoted themselves to the people, to the masses, and to their needs, which had been ignored for so long. And they did it with the slogan, Art and People United. In the field of architecture, now every building should be controlled by the avant-garde, with the aim of a große Baukunst, a great architecture for a future period of peace and for a united people. In this council, there were 56 members, among them 11 architects. For example, there was Walter Gropius, Bruno Taut, and Hans Scharoun. They were well-known protagonists who some years later will be in front of the modernist movement. of new objectivity. But in the first years after the revolution, these three and some more are also members of the more exclusive circle of artists called Gläserne Kette, chain of glass, and their sketches show utopian crystalline cathedrals for a not yet defined revolutionary cult of unity and solidarity. This was very much inspired by Bruno Taut's Glasshouse from the Werkbund exhibition in Cologne in 1914. Here I show it to you together with such a fantasy by Hans Scharoun. In the Council of Artists, all members were convinced of being avant-garde, on duty for the new republic and for a vague idea of socialism, but, and this difference really matters, it was not yet an avant-garde of a defined modernist architecture. Here was the forces of progress and tradition were still under the same roof. Please see these three architects, members of the council too. They are the pragmatic wing of the council, Paul Schmittener again, Heinrich Tessenow, and Walter Kurt-Behrendt. Later in 1919, we find them in the board of a new review, Die Volkswohnung, Housing for the People, founded from out of the Council of Artists in order to find strategies to fight one of the most urgent problems of the Republic, the disastrous housing shortage. One of the key articles in the Constitution of the Republic of Weimar had been number 115, proclaiming the right to an die Recht auf Wohnung, the right to an appropriate habitat for every citizen, a task absolutely impossible to accomplish in view of the miserable conditions during the years of crisis, but very stimulating after 1923, when a new currency was introduced and when a tax on real estate became the basis for the extensive housing programs in the cities. With Schmittener on board, the review was active in this field with all sorts of proposals how to enable housing at minimum cost. Among the contributions to the review of Schmittener, we find here a system of normalized windows in 1920. And this was later nearly exactly copied by Ernst May for the housing program at Frankfurt, which became the hotspot of public housing in combination with modernist architecture in Germany after 1925. Another element of New Frankfurt model furniture used as a means for education of tenants who should learn how to live as modern people. This example also had been given by Schmittener before in Starken 10 years earlier. You see his proposals to the right. And the difference is, the Schmittener's furniture for Starken is simple and functional, but the cupboard may look also like 1800, not yet with the aesthetics of serial production. I need not tell you what happened at the same time after the November Revolution, following the ceasefire of 1918 and the field of education in arts and architecture. In March 1919, at Weimar, we have the first Bauhaus. It was founded then by Walter Gropius. You see it here with its initial symbol, the cathedral drawn by Feininger, saying that the building of the future would be a total work of art which embraces all sections of art and crafts, and that artists shall be craftsmen, no more hierarchy among. And all that summarized in the slogan, this is now important, the slogan, crafts and art, a new unity. And look at the Bauhaus logo to the left, an expressionist collage, a little bit chaotic, with a stick man representing the merge of artists and craftsmen, holding a roof, evoking traditional signs of guilt, surrounded by ring of letters, drawn by hand. Very important. Deliberately rough. And see what happens in 1923. The new logo, a typified silhouette of man, rational, simple, drawn with rule and circle with the accuracy of the machine. It symbolizes the radical turn initiated by Gropius towards a merge of arts with industrial production. Right after the war, in the Weimar Bauhaus, at the beginning, industry had been banned from vocabulary as it evoked the horror of war and stood for the mass production of weapons and ammunition during the first industrialized war in history. In 1923, industry is now back in mind, not least under the influence of the book of Henry Ford, published in Germany, in German during the same year. In the architecture branch of the Bauhaus, Gropius with students began to dream of industrial production and the field of housing. Another school which made history in the first moments of the Weimar Republic, with Paul Schmidhenner as a protagonist on board, is ignored in most of the narratives. In October 1918, Schmidhenner, due to his efforts at Starken, at the Faculty of Architecture in Stuttgart, had been appointed to a chair for building construction. Together with his colleague Paul Bonatz, he made use of the revolutionary situation and with the support of the first democratic government, already in November 1918, I mean, this is weeks after the ceasefire, they realized a fundamental reform and created the so-called Stuttgarter Schule, School of Stuttgart, which became the most important stronghold of new tradition in Germany. No manifesto was written. I mean, these people had no idea of managing media. And there was no primary slogan such as crafts and art, a new unity, but the accent on craft was very close to the first Bauhaus. The education became pragmatic instead of academic. Here you see their buildings. I mean, up to the right, the central station of made by Bonatz, and a typical settlement of Schmidhenner after the war. There was no more training in luxurious great buildings like before, but in everyday jobs like homes, factories, schools. Function and objectivity ranked over representation. The training in opulent and sophisticated rendering was given up in favor of a modest but accurate drawing. The use of rule and lettering stencil was more or less forbidden. The student was admonished to use his hand at all points. But before 1918, it had been possible that diploma were given to students who were masters in rendering but never had seen a building site. Now, only an apprenticeship in traditional building branch enabled to become a student. The teaching may be summarized in three polarities. Exercise ranked over theory. Substance over representation. Experience over experiment. Above all, a rigid morality of craftsmanship. Architectural solutions, which were not based in qualified material and in a logical and decent construction, were not considered as serious. The use of concrete and steel was not bad, but in the perspective of craftsmen's morality, it ranked below brick, stone, and timber. Please look at this hand-drawn drawing by Schmidhenner himself for a small holiday house, which illustrates the principles of the school. At the elevation, some lines give the choice of the material. To the right, in large-scale details in section, showing how the joint from roof to wall is mastered, how a window is cut into the wall. The juxtaposition of elevations and constructive details is crucial here, as it teaches the connection of the constructive basis and the aesthetical effect of it. It was especially the reputation of Schmidhenner's lectures, who was a charismatic teacher, by the way, which let the School of Stuttgart become the most popular education for architecture during two decades, with many, many, many more students than the Bauhaus. To understand the morale of this version of German New Tradition, it is useful to look at a small house from pre-industrial 18th century in Weimar. A cubic volume in a garden, covered with white plaster, two stories, high hip roof with plain tiles, at the wall a wooden grid for flowers. If you say at first glance, not an interesting house, I agree. Architects before 1900 just would have passed. Only in this case, it is indeed a historical monument of first rank, as it was the summer house of Johann Wolfgang Goethe, the great poet of German language. After 1900, German intellectuals fell in love with his house. It was a prime example for decent and modest domesticity, cultivated by a hero of literature, who of course had the means to afford something much more rich. In its minimalism, it was the perfect antithesis of the bourgeois villa before 1900, with its high decorated nouveau riche show-off. Being functional, well-proportioned, and solid in detail, lacking ornament and facade, it was close to virtues of the modern. Around 1910, architects of the early modern began to build mere copies of it. Here you see, to the right, you see a house of Heinrich Tessenow in the first German garden city of Hellerau near Dresden. For his teaching, Schmitteiner had sent out students to Weimar for a building measurement of the Goethehaus. You see it here on the left. Until World War II, Schmitteiner realized dozens of paraphrased versions equipped with contemporary technique. By the way, in the same year when Schmitteiner's Rosa House was built in 1925, Mies van der Rohe, you see him on the left, finished the last house of his New Tradition series before he finally converted to flat roof and open volumes. So there is a certain parallelity. For Schmitteiner's Rosa House in Stuttgart of 1925, our Italian colleague Nicola Panzini has analyzed the proportions. You see it here on the right. The perimeter fits into a quadrat, which is divided in two so that the house and roof have the same height. And remarkably, and the facade is symmetry, but slightly moved out of the middle axis. Another Schmitteiner house of the same type, built in 1928 in a model settlement of a group of New Tradition architects in Berlin, in direct confrontation opposite the modernist settlement of Onkel Tom's Hütte by Bruno Taut and other architects. To the right, you see flat roofs and clean plaster. To the left, pitched roof, massive volume, muddled with a thin surface of lime plaster so that the relief of bricks shines through. While Bruno Taut shows form, Schmitteiner shows material. That was the idea. Here, the front, the same house with its front to the garden. Again, the architect makes us think that there is symmetry, but if you focus the proportions, you see that it is willfully disturbed. The upper windows do not exactly stand above the lower ones. The garret window in the roof is moved out of the middle axis, and the two chimneys, which of course was not necessary, have different forms. Minimal manipulations which only the watchful shall see. Other architects of that time have used this in order to mystify their facades. Here you see a wonderful example by Gunnar Asplund in Sweden, the Snellman House in Djursholm of 1917-18. But they never gave reasons for it. I really have never ever found an architect to explain this. In the case of Schmitteiner, I understand it as an anti-rational moment, giving his houses an organic character in opposition to the industrial machine à habiter then in vogue. Since 1925, the Schmitteiner house and its variations was widely published and became a kind of a brand. And Schmitteiner himself published his houses in 1932. A very popular book. For a part of the German public, it incarnated permanence and timelessness, That means values which help the middle classes to tolerate the uncertainties of modern times. Critiques from the side of modernism saw them as an expression of obsolete romanticism out of place in 20th century. In the year 1927, on the doorstep of Schmidhenner's school, with houses of Le Corbusier, Gropius, Mies van der Rohe, Adolf Loos, and 13 other architects, the Weissenhof exhibition and settlement took place in Stuttgart. It was a major event for media and brought the breakthrough for modernism and new objectivity. In the same year, Schmidhenner restarted his efforts in rationalization, already practiced at the Starken Garden City. On a site in Stuttgart, less than 400 meters away from the Weissenhof, but ignored by the media and by the colleagues, a complete house of the Goethe type was erected in only 5 days. His system, called Fafa, consisted of prefabricated story-high wooden frames with windows and doors already set in them. Fafa, it means fabricated timberwork, was based in regional traditions of construction in wood, but there were also affinities to the American balloon frame system. So here you have day two, day three, day six. And here you have a detail of day four. The Weissenhof houses too showed innovative materials and techniques, for sure. However, on behalf of cost saving, a crucial point for the state and for the financement of public social housing at that time, the results were very disappointing, especially for the city government of Stuttgart, which had financed the Weissenhof in order to receive a substantial reduction of cost so that more flats could be realized with the same budget. For this reason, to Schmidhenner, a settlement with 200 flats was commissioned, including 75 units in conventional construction with brick walls, so that both methods could be compared. At the end, Schmidhenner's Fafa reached a cost reduction of 24%, while Gropius and his colleagues with their experimental projects never achieved more than 10. For Gropius, who had dreamed of being the German Henry Ford of housing, it must have been a shameful experience to be outrun by a rival from new tradition. But Schmidhenner's success happened too late to influence social housing, and because in the meantime, we had Black Friday and the world economic crisis did begin, which resulted in a complete collapse of the funding of social housing by the state. We have here a completely different access to the problem. Gropius, in his rhetorics, was the number one of prefabrication and cost saving. And saying this, he organized to move the Bauhaus from Weimar to Dessau. But, I mean, he failed. And he was a master in theory. And, I mean, there is a certain explanation. Schmidhenner had built many, many, many houses, thousands. And Gropius, if you look at Gropius, what he did in housing, it is maybe 100 up to then. So here we have a publication from 1927, published during the Weissenhof event, proclaiming the victory of the modernist movement in architecture as definite and irreversible. The author Walter Kurt-Behrendt once had been an ally. We had him at the board of the Volkswohnung Review. He had promoted Schmidhenner's early work. Now he held a chief position in the building department of the Prussian Ministry of Finance, with the power to carry his point over all governmental building activities of the state in Prussia, and that was more than half of the German territory. So now he was not anymore a friend. Some new tradition architects, among them Paul Schmidhenner and Paul Bonatz, were not willing to accept. In 1928, they founded a conservative lobby group of architects called Block, which has been seen as an anticipation of later Nazi positions, in a way correctly, in another way not. The manifesto was moderate. It confirmed the impact of function of new materials and work forms, but not at any price. It rather insisted in fostering inherited and already well-crafted things. And it positioned architecture away from the internationalism of Gropius as an issue of the own nation, based on the views of life of the own people and the circumstances of the nature of the country, which have to be taken into account. Among the members, we find architects who are completely unsuspicious of political sympathy to Nazi positions, such as Hans Poelzig, Werner Hegemann. Werner Hegemann emigrated in the first days of Nazi government. Or, for example, Fritz Schumacher, who was the city architect in Hamburg, a social democratic city through and through. But there was also Paul Schulz in Hamburg, in the ranks of architectural reform, a man of great merit before 1914, but now one of the first architects openly taking side of the Nazis and a distinct racist. With his book Kunst und Rasse, Art and Race, he denounced modern art and architecture as a symptom of racial decline. In 1931, the Jewish architect Alexander Klein, known for his sophisticated studies to rationalized floor plans, was about to become a member of the Bloc. He later emigrated to Palestine and became the leading teacher for urbanism at the Technion in Israel. Schulz in Naumburg, the racist, refused his membership, and so he stayed outside. And some liberal members, among them Bonatz and Hegemann, took the occasion and left the group under protest. Mm-hmm. Schmidhenner stayed, probably as Schulz in Naumburg was a potential ally for certain ambitions towards a career with a National Socialist government, which in 1931 existed not yet, but at that time was already a possibility for the future. Opportunism here did win over solidarity, and this was Schmidhenner's position between 1931 and 1934, very clearly. These were his definite Nazi years, again close to politics. He spoke at events of the National Socialist Federation for Culture. In summer 1932, he gave his signature for Republic Appeal pro-Hitler at the elections for the Reichstag. And in spring 1933, we see him in negotiations with the first National Socialist government, which offers him the very influential position of a supervisor over all schools of architecture in Prussia. But then he passes and prefers to stay in his chair at the School of Stuttgart. His mission would have been the radical purge of the schools from dissidents and non-Aryans among the teaching personnel, which he was not willing to execute. In spite of his withdrawal, the nomination was published as if it was real, and so for a moment in 1933, many did see Schmidhenner as the forthcoming first architect of the regime. Here you have Architectural Review from London, May 1933, and this review, some months after Hitler came to power, looks at Germany and looks. I mean, who will have the jobs? And I mean, at least already Speer has arrived, yeah, with his decoration for the National Labour Day, 1st of May, 1933. But in second rank, you have Schmidhenner. As a matter of fact, Schmidhenner's career had arrived in stagnation, and in 1934, when another appeal of cultural workers for the support of Hitler was published and signed, for example, by Mies van der Rohe, who at that time still had ambitions, it did not bear anymore the signature of Schmidhenner. Mm-hmm. In 1934, a conflict occurred with Hitler personally, who more and more took decisions on architecture himself. Schmidhenner had been installed as the official architect for the German Pavilion at Brussels World Fair in 1935. His designs have not been preserved. The only source we have is a rough sketch on the backside of a letter cover that you have here. A large symmetrical hall in timber work, foreseen to be removed after the exhibition, non-monumental and cheap, due to Schmidhenner's favor for a crafted construction and to his idea that the Reich, that Germany, impoverished by the economical crisis, should perform an attitude of modesty with dignity. This little sketch on a letter is the only surviving image of his design, together with the pavilion of Albert Speer at the exhibition at the Exposition Internationale of 1937 in Paris. Hitler ridiculed the design as haystack, not appropriate for the first international appearance of his regime, and dismissed the architect from his mission. Another loser in the planning process for Brussels was Mies van der Rohe, who still remained in Germany waiting for a serious invitation from the regime. In the restricted competition held after Schmidhenner's defeat, the design of Mies, in the layout not far from the Barcelona Pavilion of 1929, had failed too. At the end, no pavilion was built, as because of valuta problems, because Germany was really poor at that time. Germany did not participate. In the meantime, Albert Speer had become the definite leading architect of the regime and the alter ego of the architect manqué Adolf Hitler, who more and more took decisions on architecture himself. You know the result, a new representative architecture for Germany as the fascist superpower was developed in a hypertropic neoclassicism, ready to break with any proportion and urban scale. Schmidhenner was convinced that more and more the official architecture was the opposite of his own philosophy and of the teaching of his school. He answered in ciphered aphorisms during his lecture, such as, "The first thing that dying people lose is scale." His lecture, with a cryptic title, "The Gentle Law in the Arts, Especially in Architecture," became an insider tip and was even published several times until 1943. On the cover, you see the silhouette of the Strasbourg Cathedral. Schmidhenner, the man from Alsace, took it as an example of what he understood as true greatness in architecture, out of reach for the architects around Speer. In Berlin, Friedrich Thams, an architect in the team of Speer, was authorized to publish a counterstatement printed in March 1944. It confronted Schmidhenner with a hard law in architecture, and it said that buildings of always some monumental greatness had been created during history all the time, and that the National Socialist great projects were legitimate and based in a glorious continuity since the pyramids here. And as a proof, the Strasbourg Cathedral is given again, now in a different sense, a deliberately sarcastic revenge against Schmidhenner. However, Schmidhenner was not consequent in his opposition. At several occasions, he still took part in competitions for representative projects, but he conceived his designs as pure architectural studies with no possibility for realization, as from 1940 on, he did not believe anymore that Germany would win the war. Look here at his design for a court with stapled arcades at a future polytechnical school at Linz in Austria. The drawing was published in 1941. When we checked the original drawing, we had it at the Schmidhenner exhibition in 2003 in Frankfurt. We found out that over the two portals, you see one of them here on the right, he had scratched out three swastikas before he gave the piece to the photographer. That means in 1941, and not after 1945, to wipe out a Nazi past before denazification, he did this. In a way, the drawing returned to him, and he liked to think that it was his private study with no more connection to politics and to the regime, of course, a self-pleasing illusion. And have a look to another great project, the competition for a monumental upgrade of Strasbourg, which since the annexion of 1940 was German again, only for a short time. On one hand, Schmidhenner appreciated the return of his land to Germany. On the other hand, he was split into identities, the Alsatian from origin and the German patriot he became. When in 1943, seven men from Alsace with contact to the French resistance faced the death penalty, he dared launch an open letter to the law court in order to save the lives and asked his friends to follow his example. I mean, at that time, a very courageous act. And he was successful with that. It later helped Smetana to make friends with a French military governor in Germany, but that would be another story. Now, I am ready, but two footnotes, please. Strasbourg, this plan for Strasbourg, of course, was not realized, but few people know, at Stuttgart, Königsplatz, there is a Schmidtener building from 1950 for Dresdner Bank, then still under Allied control, that means American control, and the facade scheme had been developed for Strasbourg, and now in a very much slimmed version, less heavy, it was used for this building in Stuttgart. So we have a fragment of the Strasbourg plan survived on the other side of the Rhine. And a second footnote. J'aurais pu ce texte en français. Mais vous comprenez peut-être il aurait fallu quelques jours plus pour élaborer ça. Et j'avais pas ce temps. Merci beaucoup.